Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to MitoAction's monthly expert series. Today, Jamie Peterson, licensed genetic counselor at the Mitochondrial Medicine Frontier Program at CHOP, is with us to share primary mitochondrial disease evaluations, the evolving role of muscle biopsy. My name is Stephanie Harry. I'm the patient support coordinator at MitoAction and will be your host for today. Today's presentation will be recorded and available on MitoAction's website in the coming days, as well as on our podcast, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the presentation using the Q&A feature on the bottom menu bar of your screen. The chat section is for you to talk with your families, with other families and clinicians who are on the space today, but it's really helpful if you have questions to put all your questions for the presenter in the Q&A section and not in the chat. This helps us to stay better organized at the end of today's presentation, and we will try to get to everyone's question, at the end of the presentation if possible. Genetic testing and muscle biopsies are important tools in diagnosing mitochondrial disease, but sometimes it can be confusing how and when they're used. This presentation will seek to bring clarity around how these two different testing options are used, why clinics may choose to use one testing option over another, and what information they can and cannot tell us, and how clinics use these options to determine a diagnosis of mitochondrial disease. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce Jamie Peterson. Jamie has worked as a clinical genetic counselor in the Mitochondrial Medicine Frontier Program at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia since 2018. He leads and coordinates the MMFP's GC trainee clinical rotation schedule and has also been a biocurator for ClinGen Primary Mitochondrial Disease Gen Curation Expert Panel since 2021. His research interests lie in improving diagnostic testing options in primary mitochondrial disease and streamlining the diagnostic testing process. Jamie, we're so excited that you're here today. I know that we have a lot of questions, and I'm really excited for you to get started. And your area of interest is so very, very important. Trying to better understand how we diagnose patients with primary mitochondrial disease.
Thanks so much, Stephanie. I really appreciate the invitation to speak today. I've been really excited to chat with you all. And with that being said, I'll start sharing my screen and we can get started here in a moment. And Stephanie, once I start in presentation mode, I wouldn't mind if you would, could you confirm that my slides are showing
You're
now?
good. Yes,
Perfect.
absolutely.
Thank you so much. And yeah, thank you again for inviting me to speak today. I'm really excited to talk about sort of the evolving role of muscle biopsy and the diagnostic evaluations for primary mitochondrial diseases today. And just a few administrative items before we get started. I have no financial disclosures or conflicts of interest to report. And I do want to just highlight sort of the genetic counselor scope of practice under the licensure laws for Pennsylvania, where I'm licensed. And so the scope of practice of genetic counselors, and this is a bit of a synopsis here, but it is largely to interpret family history, aid in determining diagnostic laboratory selection and interpreting diagnostic laboratory results, and explaining implications of diagnostic testing results, in addition to documenting medical history, et cetera. One of the limitations of my scope of practice is that I cannot give explicit, medical advice. And so, thinking about our discussion today, I do want to do a bit of a background about genetics and specifically the history of diagnostics of mitochondrial disorders, because I think this foundation is really helpful to have in terms of understanding where the field is today and why certain changes have been present. And so, I apologize if there might be many of you on the call who this might seem, a bit elementary to, but I think this foundation is really crucial to understanding sort of where we've been and where we are now. But just to kick it off, thinking about genetics, of course, DNA stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. And the sort of analogy I use for DNA is that it's like a blueprint or instruction manual for our body. And it is made up of four building blocks that are called nucleotides. And a lot of people refer to these as letters. And these four letters are A, C, T, and G, which stand for adenine, cytosine, thymine, and guanine, that you see on the right there. And thinking about DNA as sort of like an instruction manual for our body, a lot of times people use the word gene, and it's kind of tricky to understand what the word gene means. because it actually means a few different things. But maybe the simplest way to understand what the word gene means is if we think of our DNA like instruction manual for our body, genes are like chapters in the instruction manual. And they provide, sets of instructions that tell our body how to make a specific protein. And so while we're thinking about this instruction manual, we're thinking about genetic conditions, excuse me, changes in the DNA. Historically, in the past, they've been referred to as mutations, and in recent years, these have started to be shifted towards being called variants. And variants are broadly categorized into one of three different classifications. The first classification being benign, which I've highlighted in green there. Benign variants are not reported out on genetic testing reports because we have thousands upon thousands of benign variants. I'll start at or I'll shift to the bottom classification, pathogenic, which refers to a variant or a change in the DNA that would cause symptoms. And the important caveat here is that if it's inherited in the appropriate manner. And what I mean by that is, if some of you may remember back to high school biology lessons with, your Punnett squares, with your big B, little b, little b, little b, there are sort of two inheritance patterns that people commonly think about with genetic conditions. And those are autosomal recessive conditions where people need two pathogenic variants, one from their mother, one from their father. And then autosomal dominant conditions where people only need a single pathogenic variant. Now, of course, with mitochondrial diseases, inheritance patterns are significantly more common, complicated, which we'll chat about in a moment. And I'm really just trying to sort of illustrate sort of the classifications of variants. The third category, which some of you may be familiar with, of variants that comes up quite frequently is what's called a variant of uncertain significance, or a VUS, or sometimes people call it a VOUS. And a variant of uncertain significance, which I've highlighted in gray there, I know it doesn't quite stand out, variants of uncertain significance are changes in the DNA that are unclear if they would cause symptoms or not. Oftentimes, they're rare variants that aren't reported in the general population, but there's no functional studies showing that they cause an effect to the gene, and they're not reported in people in the literature. And so, due to the lack of information, they get put into this third category of uncertain significance. Now, it's recognized in the community that the vast majority of variants of uncertain significance later on down the line are reclassified as benign variants. And, estimates are somewhere between 70 and 80% of variants of uncertain significance end up being reclassified as benign. So then thinking about mitochondrial disorders, and specifically the genetics in mitochondrial disorders, which are a bit more complicated. I've been talking primarily about our nuclear DNA here. This is the DNA that's inherited from both our mother and our father that you see on the top right there are 23 pairs of chromosomes, again, one from mom, one from dad. And then the 23rd chromosome is the sex chromosome, two X chromosomes being a biological female, an X and a Y chromosome being a biological male. Now, why is this called nuclear DNA? Well, if we look to the left, and I see now that the flipped image there, but essentially this is a cell, and I apologize for the flipped image, but if you look in the center of the cell, that orange sphere is the nucleus of the cell. It's the central part of the cell, and that is where the nuclear DNA is stored. The blue elongated objects are the mitochondria. And when we're thinking about mitochondrial disorders can be caused by both nuclear DNA variants, but they can also be caused by mitochondrial DNA variants, which are these tiny circles of DNA within the mitochondria itself. And the mitochondrial DNA is different from the nuclear DNA in a number of different ways. But one of the main points that I want to highlight with the mitochondrial DNA is that the genes in the mitochondrial DNA essentially provide instructions instructions, excuse me, that create proteins that help the mitochondria make energy. And so thinking about these two different pools of mitochondrial DNA, both need to be assessed for a thorough mitochondrial disease evaluation. Our nuclear DNA, as I mentioned before, has 23 pairs of chromosomes, so only two copies of each gene, one's from biological mom, one's from biological dad. There's approximately 20,000 genes in the nuclear DNA. And one thing that I want to highlight about the 20,000 genes is while we have testing capabilities to look at all 20,000 genes, we only know how about 7,000 out of 20,000 genes are related to human disease and symptoms. And so that is one of the biggest limitations to any genetic testing is that there's many genes whose function and how it relates to people's symptoms are just unknown. And then for nuclear DNA, there's multiple different inheritance patterns. I've talked about two, autosomal dominant and autosomal recessive. There are, of course, other inheritance patterns such as X-linked inheritance patterns as well. This is compared with the mitochondrial DNA, which is different in a number of different ways. First and foremost, the mitochondrial DNA, rather than having only two copies, there's multiple copies of mitochondrial DNA. Each mitochondrion, which is a single mitochondria, has anywhere from 2 to 10 copies in the mitochondrion. And if we go back a slide, you'll notice that there are multiple mitochondria in a cell. In this particular image on the left, you see three. Usually there's a lot more than three per cell. But the point of that there being that there's multiple copies of mitochondrial DNA, and we'll talk about the significance of that later in our conversation. It's significantly smaller. There's only 37 genes in the mitochondrial DNA, and our mitochondrial DNA is maternally inherited. And one of the limitations of mitochondrial DNA, or I shouldn't say limitations, one of the important caveats is that, well, nuclear DNA genetic testing people will often do in blood, saliva, or cheek swab. Mitochondrial DNA testing certainly can be done in those tissues as well. But it's possible that there are mitochondrial DNA variants that are absent in blood, saliva, cheek swab, but might be present in other tissues like urine or muscle tissue, which I'll chat about later, which is why I have a little asterisk next to that point. Now, I think one thing that I want to mention about the genetics of mitochondrial disease and inheritance patterns is that both nuclear DNA and mitochondrial DNA can have what are called de novo variants. And de novo is the Latin word that literally means from the beginning. And basically what a de novo variant is it's a change in the DNA that's unique to that person, meaning neither of the parents have that variant. And everyone has de novo variants. They're part of what make us unique from our parents, our siblings. You know, even identical twins will have de novo variants that make them just very slightly distinct from one another. And I think really the take-home point that I want to emphasize with this slide here is that there are multiple different inheritance patterns with primary mitochondrial disease. And so then one of the questions that always comes up is, you know, everybody talks about how the mitochondria are the powerhouse of the cell. Well, how do they make energy? And I realize this is, a very cartoony image here, but this is in lay terms, how I think about how the mitochondria make energy. The way they make energy is through a series of what I like to think of as energy factories that are referred to as complexes. Now, they're called complexes because they have many genes or proteins that go into them to make up the complex. And the way energy is made is that electrons are shuttled from one complex to the next, and the shuttling of electrons basically allows energy production in the form of ATP through that last complex, complex five. And getting a little cute here with my image here, but the reason why there's a boat crossing over the water there is part of the reaction that goes on here is sort of reaction of water to oxygen. And really, the form of energy that's being made through the mitochondria is ATP. And this is just another sort of representation of a much more scientific representation of what I was showing with my previous little cartoon with the warehouses and the energy factory here as well. And so you'll notice on complex four, you've got the oxygen going to water, which is sort of what I was going at with that little cute little boat image there. So that's sort of our background about genetics and the mitochondria and how the mitochondria make energy. Now, throughout this lecture, there's going to be a few terms that I use that I wanted to review before getting into the full discussion. The first being primary mitochondrial disease. And the next slide, I'll chat about what is the definition of primary mitochondrial disease. But throughout this lecture, PMD is the abbreviation I use for that. Another abbreviation that will come up is either ETC or oxidative phosphorylation or OxPhos. And these are essentially the energy factories, the complexes 1 through 5. From a technical perspective, the electron transport chain is actually complexes 1 through 4 because those are the complexes that electrons are passed between. And oxidative phosphorylation encompasses complexes 1 through 5. So some other important terms are phenotype, which describes a constellation of someone's symptoms. Variant, we talked about earlier, which is a change in the DNA. People use the phrase genome quite often, and what genome refers to is a complete sequence of DNA. And usually there's a qualifying word before that, either the nuclear DNA genome or the mitochondrial DNA genome, to specify which pool of DNA you're talking about. And then two genetic tests that people may have heard of before that we'll chat about are whole exome sequencing and whole genome sequencing. Both of these tests look at all 20,000 genes. The distinction between the two is that the exome sequencing tests about 1 to 2% of the DNA. And the reason why it's looking at 1 to 2% of the DNA is this is the part of the DNA that ultimately gets turned into protein. We call it the coding region of the DNA. And this is where most disease-causing symptoms are expected to be found. About 80 to 85% of disease-causing symptoms are expected to be found in this part of the nuclear DNA genome. Whole genome sequencing, on the other hand, refers to testing that analyzes the entire genome. Oftentimes, it includes the mitochondrial genome as well, but that can vary. And while it covers the entire genome, there are some parts of our DNA that are a little bit trickier to interpret than others. So, in other words, while it is the most comprehensive test available, there's still no silver bullet, perfectly comprehensive test that tests for absolutely everything. Now, people may look at this and say, well, genome sequencing is more comprehensive. Why wouldn't people just offer that? And it's a complicated answer. One of the simplest explanations is that genome sequencing is not a test that's routinely covered by insurance. Exome sequencing is sort of considered the gold standard test within genetics, and it is the test that is most often covered by insurance when you're thinking about comprehensive genetic testing. So, what is PMD, or primary mitochondrial disease? So, a primary mitochondrial disease, it's an inborn error of metabolism, and about 1 in 4,000 people have primary mitochondrial disease. And the definition is that a primary mitochondrial disease refers to someone who has genetic changes in genes that affect oxidative phosphorylation. And this is going back to, the images that I showed you of the warehouses and the energy factory to make ATP. There's over 400 genes that are associated with primary mitochondrial disease. And as we talked about, there are two genomes, our nuclear DNA and our mitochondrial DNA. And one of the most difficult things about describing primary mitochondrial disease is the constellation of symptoms, or the phenotype, is really tricky to describe because it's so clinically heterogeneous, meaning variable. People can have any age of onset. While these are described as progressive conditions, meaning people's symptoms get worse over time, the rate of progression is quite variable. And some people can have stable symptoms, of course, for decades. Other things that are challenging in terms of describing the phenotype is that in some instances, you have people who have multisystemic symptoms, symptoms in their eyes, their heart, their muscles, their brain, versus some people who have symptoms in just a single organ system, like Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy, which primarily affects the eye. And so the way we've started to shift our thinking about when should suspicion for a primary mitochondrial disease be raised is when people have red flag symptoms, what I'll call red flag symptoms, with or without abnormal biochemical labs. So what are some red flag symptoms? On my next slide, I'll go into a little bit more detail about that, but people probably recognize sort of these classic primary mitochondrial disease syndromes, things like Mie loss, things like MRF, things like Leigh syndrome or Kearns-Sayre syndrome or Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy. Now, where do these come from? These names come from, actually, most of them come from about the 90s or so when physicians were describing people with these conditions. They were literally describing the symptoms that they were displaying. And at that time, we didn't have the understanding of what the genetic causes to these people's symptoms were. And so that's why there's so many of these acronyms and these names, is because these mitochondrial disorders were actually discovered before their genetic causes were discovered. And so the syndromes are really descriptions of symptoms that people have. And I think a lot of times that gets confused with the genetic testing results, meaning that sometimes people assume because you have a genetic variant that you have a syndrome, but that's not necessarily the case. You may be at risk for different symptoms, excuse me, with that particular variant. And so when these terms are used, like Mie loss or Leigh syndrome, they're describing very specific constellations of symptoms that are seen in a person. So, what are some of the red flag features of primary mitochondrial disease in addition to these classic syndromes? And I've highlighted some of the ones in bold that are probably most suspicious when they stand alone by themselves. You know, things like ptosis, which is drooping eyelids, or ophthalmoplegia, where people have limited eye movements due to muscle weakness in their eyes. Babies who have liver failure and liver problems are also, you know, people tend to think about mitochondrial disorders for them as well, as babies who have issues with balancing their acids and bases and lactate that goes particularly high. And there are, of course, many other symptoms that can be seen in mitochondrial diseases, but those ones that I've highlighted in bold are some of the ones where those symptoms by themselves raise a pretty high suspicion for a mitochondrial disease. And then for the other symptoms that are listed on there, they're not meant to be exhaustive, but once you start to see multiple of those symptoms present in a person at the same time, that's when suspicion can be raised even higher. So now that I've done a review of the genetics and sort of what a primary mitochondrial disease definition is and what primary mitochondrial disease looks like, I'll start to transition into how do we diagnose mitochondrial disease. And before I do that, I think it's helpful to give some context to what is the history of primary mitochondrial disease. And really, it starts as far back as 1871, where Theodor Leber first described people with maternally inherited vision loss. It was called Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy. Now, of course, at this point in time, Dr. Leber did not know that this was a mitochondrial disease. He was simply describing optic neuropathy that was matrilineal, meaning maternally inherited. And so from that point, it is actually probably close to 100 years before people really started to drill down into what are mitochondrial diseases. And in the 1960s, there were you know, sort of two seminal papers from Luft et al., Dr. Luft, and Engel et al., where Dr. Luft, it was one of the first times that people had looked in muscle tissue and described the function of oxidative phosphorylation. And he noted that there was abnormal oxidative phosphorylation in people with a mitochondrial disorder. So this was really the first time that symptoms had been linked to abnormally functioning mitochondria. And shortly thereafter, Engel et al. Developed the Gomori trichrome stain, which a variant of which is still used today on the muscle biopsy test, where they're looking at the fibers specifically for ragged red fibers. And then, of course, in the 70s, there were multiple different enzyme assays that were developed as well. So in the 1960s and 70s, they were really looking at trying to capture the function of the mitochondria. And the enzymes involved in the mitochondria. And this is, you know, really where sort of the thought that you need a muscle biopsy to diagnose a mitochondrial disease comes from. And then we shift to the 1980s, which is where DNA starts to be discovered, and specifically the mitochondrial DNA. And in 1981, Anderson et al. Mapped the entire mitochondrial DNA, which was massively important for the discovery of mitochondrial DNA diseases. And then in 1988, there were two papers that came out linking mitochondrial DNA mutations to abnormal mitochondrial functions. Holt et al. Discovered a mitochondrial DNA deletion that caused mitochondrial dysfunction of the oxidative phosphorylation. And then Wallace et al. Discovered that the 11778 G to A variant was causing at least some cases of Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy. And so in the late 1980s, we get the link between genetics and dysfunction in the muscle tissue, looking at the mitochondrial function. And so then throughout the 90s and up until really 2010, the acquisition, I should say, of identifying new genetic conditions and linking them to mitochondrial dysfunction. This is where we start to see where the classic syndromes come up, like knee loss and MRF and the genetic explanations, or at least the most common ones for those conditions. And of course, in 2000, the Human Genome Project was completed. And really between 2010, people were doing single gene testing. And so the discovery of novel genetic mitochondrial diseases was actually quite slow. But then where we really start to see this explode, and this is where the shift from muscle biopsy to genetics happens, is when next generation sequencing, which is what NGS stands for, came about in 2010. And so next generation sequencing was this dramatic shift that went from testing just a single gene at a time to testing thousands of genes at once. And this paved the way for whole exome sequencing and eventually whole genome sequencing. And with the creation of exome sequencing and genome sequencing in this era, we then started linking multiple different genes. And as I mentioned earlier, there's over 400 genes that are associated with mitochondrial dysfunction to mitochondrial abnormalities in muscle tissue. And so this was really where we started to see this shift from mitochondrial disorders need to be diagnosed by muscle biopsy, which was really true in especially like the 80s and 90s, because we only knew a handful of genes at that point in time, to by the time we got to really about 2015 or so, genetic testing was really considered the gold standard for diagnosis of primary mitochondrial disorders. And as I mentioned earlier, I do want to emphasize that we still don't know the function of all of our genes. There's, you know, depending on whose article you read, somewhere between 5,000 and 7,000 genes that are associated with genetic disease, and about 400 or so of them are mitochondrial disorders. So many more to discover. So how is a mitochondrial disease diagnosed? And as I was mentioning on the previous slide, a confirmed primary mitochondrial disease diagnosis requires genetic confirmation. And a lot of people ask, you know, why? And this is because the symptoms of primary mitochondrial disease, while there are classic syndromes, like we talked about earlier, like knee loss and MRF and Kearns-Sayre syndrome, that are highly suspicious of a mitochondrial disorder, quite often the symptoms in primary mitochondrial disease can be very nonspecific. And previously, people have used rules like, oh, if there's three organ systems involved, this should raise a concern for mitochondrial disease. But just using one example, you know, fatigue, GI issues, and headaches, that equals three organ systems. And the differential diagnosis for that combination of symptoms is exceptionally broad. And it includes non-genetic conditions like people who are chronically dehydrated will have all of those symptoms as well. And so this is why genetic testing was really used as sort of the gold standard for diagnosis, because your DNA, specifically your germline DNA, doesn't change over time. And so that to that point, sort of how do we narrow down potential causes of symptoms that are not specific but get a little bit more specific? The way that's done is through genetic testing. And so as I mentioned earlier, genetic testing evaluates what's called germline DNA. And what does that mean? So our germline DNA, so this is the DNA that we're born with. And as I mentioned earlier, it's divided into two pools, our nuclear DNA and our mitochondrial DNA. And our germline DNA is not expected to change over time. Now, there's a caveat with that as it relates to mitochondrial DNA. So I'll come back to that later. But the key take-home point is that your germline DNA, especially your nuclear DNA, is not expected to change over time, which is why genetic testing is used for confirmation of diagnosis. Now, this is juxtaposed with muscle biopsy. Now, remember, muscle biopsy was the gold standard in the 70s, 80s, and 90s for diagnosis. Even in the early 2000s or so, muscle biopsy was still used as the gold standard for mitochondrial disease diagnoses. But muscle biopsies are very tricky. They're incredibly sensitive to handling and collection procedures. And you can get false positive results from mishandling or improper storage, improper shipping. And if you look, so I write different tissues, but I mean specifically different muscles. If you take a muscle biopsy of the deltoid versus a muscle biopsy of the thigh versus a muscle biopsy of the abdominal muscles, those muscles are going to have different mitochondrial densities and they're going to look different. And so that's another layer of complexity to muscle biopsy. And then studies have shown that if you do repeat biopsies, it might look different from biopsy to one to biopsy two, even if it's from the same muscle tissue. And so therefore, that's why there was really this biopsy, the shift was from biopsy-driven paradigm to a genetic testing-driven paradigm. Because again, our germline DNA is not expected to change over time. And while muscle biopsy plays a crucial supportive role in raising concern for a mitochondrial disease, just because of the nature of the procedure and the handling and all of those other points, there's a lot of caveats into interpreting muscle biopsy results. So this slide is really a recap of previous slides. So I won't spend too much time on it, but we have four nucleotides, A, C, T, and G. A's pair with T's, C's pair with G's. And this is why they're called base pairs. And our DNA, I used the instruction manual analogy earlier. Some people call it a blueprint. And basically, what double helix refers to is just sort of that windy spiral shape to the DNA, which is created by pairing the two letters together. Oh. And fortunately, I included image of the cell here that is not flipped upside down. So you can see the nucleus is this bracket that includes the nuclear pore, the nucleolus, which is that red dot in the center. So the nucleus itself is sort of that orange sphere in the center of the cell. And the blue elongated shapes are the mitochondria. And this is a slide that we talked about earlier, but what I'm going to focus on this is that the bullet point that I highlighted in bold is that mitochondrial DNA can look different in different tissues. And where this really relates is to this idea of heteroplasmy and homoplasmy. And what do those words mean? So, because we have multiple copies of mitochondrial DNA, when a variant is present, the lab, when they test for that variant, they will tell us what percentage of copies of mitochondrial DNA carry that variant. And that is what's referred to as heteroplasmy. If someone carries a variant in every single copy of their mitochondrial DNA, it's referred to as homoplasmic. That means 100%. But if it's a percentage less than 100%, then it's heteroplasmy. And so what these two images are showing here is that the first image on the left from Rambani et al. Is showing maternal inheritance of mitochondrial DNA. So when a woman carries a mitochondrial DNA variant and she's heteroplasmic for that variant, and I think if my math is right, this woman carries a variant which is marked by the orange mitochondria. The blue mitochondria do not have the variant. So she would be probably about 25% heteroplasmic for that variant. Every time she has a child, though, there is a random selection of mitochondria. And as you can see in that picture, if the random selection of mitochondria includes more mitochondria with the variant, then the child could have a higher level heteroplasmy than the mom. And in that top row there, that's an instance where the heteroplasmy level is around 75% or 80%, which is compared with that bottom row there, where most of the mitochondria that were selected to be passed on to the child were mitochondria without the variant. And so that represents lower level of heteroplasmy, only about 20%. Now, well, this is what happens when mothers pass their mitochondrial DNA onto their children. As the embryo divides, mitochondrial DNA continue to be selected, and this happens for all of our organ tissues as well. And so, as you can maybe predict from there, depending on which mitochondria are selected to become the beginning cells or the progenitor cells of certain organ tissues, there might be different levels of heteroplasmy. And so, this is what the image on the right is showing here: is different organs might have different levels of the variant. Now, what you'll notice about many of these organs is we don't do brain biopsies, we don't do heart biopsies, we certainly don't do biopsies of the retina. And so this is why the gold standard has been considered skeletal muscle, is because skeletal muscle takes a lot of energy to run, and it's invasive, but it's considered a minimally invasive organ to collect and test for mitochondrial DNA. And so then, one of the most important concepts when thinking about mitochondrial DNA disorders is this idea of the threshold effect. And the threshold effect is basically the level at which a mitochondrial DNA variant starts to manifest in symptoms, the heteroplasmy level at which the mitochondrial DNA variant starts to manifest in symptoms. And one thing that's important to know is that this level varies from variants to variant. Certain variants, you need very high levels of the variant in order to cause symptoms, levels over 85, 90% before people show any symptoms. Other variants, you might only need 20, or well, probably closer to 30%, 40% in order for symptoms to manifest. And one of the main reasons for muscle biopsy is to make sure that there is not a mitochondrial DNA variant that exceeds the threshold effect in muscle, because most often the levels of these mutations are higher in muscle. Or sorry, the way I should phrase that is, if there is going to be a difference in heteroplasmy levels between different organs, it will be highest in muscle compared to blood, saliva, or cheek swab, which is why we use that as sort of a test to rule out mitochondrial DNA causes to people's symptoms. Now, what's a practical example of this? And I just want to highlight that this is a fabricated a case example that is reflective of many cases, but it's not specific to any one person. So there's a 35-year-old man. He has double vision, and he notices that his eyelids have been drooping as time goes on, which is called ptosis. So he goes to the eye doctor. The eye doctor examines him and says he has ophthalmoplegia, which is, again, as I mentioned earlier, weakness of the eye muscles that limit his eye movements. And this is in part what's causing his double vision. So he gets genetic testing, and they send a cheek swab. And the genetic test is a great first-tier test. It looks at both the nuclear DNA and the mitochondrial DNA, but it's negative. So then he gets sent for a muscle biopsy, and this person carries a mitochondrial DNA deletion in his muscle at 40% heteroplasmy, which confirms his primary mitochondrial disease. So I used some language a moment ago called a first-tier test. And what I mean by that is, sort of the first test that you send when there's a concern for a genetic condition. And we always start, or I shouldn't say always, but we nearly always start with a non-invasive first-tier test that can be done on blood, saliva, or cheek swab, which is a buccal swab. And I talked about exome sequencing and genome sequencing earlier. Some people may choose to do panel testing. The difference between panel testing and exome sequencing is that a panel test includes a set number of genes. It might be 100 genes, it might be 200 genes, it might be 400 genes, but it is a limited number of genes, and the lab will look for variants in any of those genes. This is compared with exome and genome sequencing, where they do look at all 20,000 genes, but they are focusing on genes that are related to the person's symptoms, as the doctor reports them on the testing request. When we think about mitochondrial DNA sequencing, we first try to start in a non-invasive sample, and that's usually a cheek swab, blood, or saliva. If it's negative or unrevealing, you might move on to urine, or you might move on to a muscle biopsy. And a muscle biopsy, as I mentioned earlier, is needed to completely exclude a mitochondrial DNA disorder. But there's really a balance here that doctors sort of weigh with patients about recommending an invasive procedure. A muscle biopsy requires general anesthesia. It's an open surgery. Well, it's a small risk. There's, of course, a small risk of infection. And so there's a little bit of a discussion and a balance of what, how suspicious are we that the muscle biopsy is going to be abnormal for a mitochondrial disease, and balancing the risks and benefits of pursuing a muscle biopsy rather than just blatantly recommending invasive procedures simply to exclude a condition when the suspicion for that condition may be low. So what do people test for on a muscle biopsy? And there's a number of different tests on a muscle biopsy. Almost all muscle biopsies go for muscle histology. And this is where they're looking at the muscle fibers, and it acts as a screen for muscular dystrophies, inflammatory muscle diseases, et cetera. And this is where the ragged red fibers that people maybe have heard of, or Cox negative fibers, are identified. In a similar vein, some institutions might perform electron microscopy, but this varies from institution to institution. And not all institutions will perform electron microscopy because there's conflicting evidence on its utility when muscle histology is normal. But then, in terms of the specific mitochondrial tests, I've talked a lot about mitochondrial DNA sequencing and deletion analysis, which I've put in bold. From our perspective, that is what we consider the most important muscle test because this is the only way to completely exclude a mitochondrial DNA variant. Of course, it's a balance of risk and benefit on whether a muscle biopsy seems like an appropriate decision. There's also ways to look at the mitochondrial electron transport chain, or respiratory chain is a phrase that sometimes gets used interchangeably. And this is essentially looking at the function of the electron transport chain. Are the complexes making energy appropriately, or are there any deficiencies? And I put a little asterisk next to this is because these were the tests that were the previous gold standard from the 80s and the 90s and the early 2000s for mitochondrial disease diagnoses. These are now used as supportive evidence, and I'll come back to this a bit later, but the reason why they're used as supportive evidence is we've actually learned over time that people can have abnormalities on their mitochondrial electron transport chain that don't actually originate from a primary mitochondrial disease. And I'll come back to that in a moment. But all that is to say, it is the combination of the genetic testing with the muscle testing that creates the clearest picture for diagnosis in those instances. Some other tests that we look at are the amount of mitochondrial DNA. Some people have conditions where they don't make enough mitochondrial DNA, and that's what causes their symptoms. Again, that can be a tricky test to interpret, though, because things like disuse atrophy, when people have muscle pain, it can be very difficult to exercise, and our muscles respond to that lack of stimulus by not making as much mitochondria. They say, oh, my muscle isn't getting the stimulus. I don't need to make as much energy. And so the mitochondrial amount goes down. As well as looking at what's sort of like a vitamin called CoQ10 that acts as a little shuttle between the different complexes that can also be looked at in muscle tissue as well. Now, I've heard that there are a lot of questions about what exactly is a ragged red fiber. And so I pulled up an image of a ragged red fiber here. So this is a muscle biopsy that's undergone Gomori trichrome stain, and normal fibers stain blue. And ragged red fibers stain red, which is why they're called ragged red fibers. And the name originally comes from is because when the pathologists were first looking at these many years ago, they thought the streaks through the middle looked like red fibers from a dress. And basically, what a ragged red fiber is it shows accumulation of mitochondria at the surface of the muscle cell, which suggests, and lots of mitochondria. And that proliferation and accumulation of mitochondria suggests that there's an energy problem. And to use an analogy, if you have something that takes 10 volts of energy to run, and you have a battery that makes 10 volts, and you just need one battery. Well, what if your battery only makes 2 volts? How do you get those 10 volts? You get five batteries. And so you have five batteries that each independently don't work as efficiently, but because there's five of them, you meet the energy demand. And that's sort of the general thought process and theory behind why this proliferation happens in mitochondrial disease. But again, one thing that can be tricky, and this is a bit of a theme of this conversation, is that the changes that are associated with mitochondrial disease can also have other causes. Ragged red fibers, we know that they are acquired with age at relatively low frequencies, but they can be acquired with age. And there's other conditions like inclusion body myositis that can cause ragged red fibers. This slide here is just meant to be an illustrative example of different types of tests that can be done in different tissues. One thing that I will say is, while we do not actively pursue heart biopsies, in some instances, cardiology does a heart biopsy. And if there is heart tissue left over, then it can be used for testing. So I do just want to emphasize that there is that a heart biopsy is not something that is actively pursued by mitochondrial diagnosticians, but if there is heart tissue, it can be tested. And for liver biopsies, those are performed typically at the discretion of a person's liver team when they have liver symptoms. So again, liver biopsies are also not typically performed at the discretion of mitochondrial diagnosticians. It's usually performed by the managing team. And if there's liver tissue left over, then it can be tested. And so this table here is just showing the variety of different tests that can be done in different tissues. And one test that I haven't talked about is what's called a complex one Western blot. Earlier, I talked about how these complexes are called complexes because they have many proteins or genes that come together. And basically, what a Western blot is it tells us are all of the pieces of the complex coming together appropriately. And at least as of now, that test can only be clinically offered in fibroblasts. And what I mean by clinically offered is you go to a doctor, they recommend a test, they send the test, you get a report back in X number of days, weeks, or months after the testing is done. As opposed to a research test, where research tests are not guaranteed to come with a report. And so I think one of the outstanding questions is why are fewer clinics offering muscle biopsy? And probably one of the primary reasons is muscle biopsies are hard to collect. They require partners in general surgery and pathology for appropriate handling, collection, shipping. And as I mentioned earlier, muscle tissue is very sensitive to processing steps, and it can affect the results if not handled appropriately. Ideally, muscle tissue is collected from a specific muscle called the vastus lateralis for mitochondrial functional testing. That's actually not, I don't know why I put that with hard to collect, but that's just a side note. But more importantly, very few labs actually do the testing that we've talked about on a clinical basis in the United States. And many doctors might not be aware of the labs that offer those tests. And interpreting the results takes quite a bit of training specific to mitochondrial disease. And then, in a similar vein, insurance approval, and I know this firsthand, it can be really hard to obtain for getting these tests. And if insurance approval isn't obtained for these tests, sometimes they can cost thousands of dollars out of pocket. And at least one of our goals is to make sure that there are no unexpected exorbitant out-of-pocket costs to patients. And then actually I mentioned this a bit earlier, but the tests are hard to interpret and can be misleading. And what I mean by that is oftentimes you'll see quote unquote false positives. And what I mean by that is, while there may be a deficiency, like a complex one deficiency, that might not be due to a mitochondrial disease. And the best example I can give of these is, complex one deficiency is actually reported in Down syndrome, but Down syndrome is not a primary mitochondrial disease. It's caused by trisomy 21, which means three copies of the 21st chromosome, and there's thousands of genes on the 21st chromosome. And many of these genes aren't involved in any mitochondrial functions. And so it's not appropriate to call Down syndrome a primary mitochondrial disease because there's a number of different mechanisms at play, but they can have complex one deficiency, which would be an example of what we would call secondary mitochondrial dysfunction. And then, one example I gave earlier is that as we age, people acquire ragged rib fibers and Cox negative fibers. And so, with that being said, that brings me to my summary slide here. Mitochondrial disease diagnoses require genetic testing for confirmation, which is commonly done through blood, cheek swab, and saliva samples on either whole exome sequencing, genome sequencing, or dual genome panels. And muscle biopsies have really shifted from this gold standard to a supportive role. They're the only way to exclude mitochondrial DNA variants. But of course, my triple star there is there's a balance of recommending an invasive procedure with risk and benefit in terms of ruling out a variant versus risk of undergoing an invasive procedure. And muscle biopsies can actually be really helpful in providing functional support for variants of uncertain significance. Which I didn't talk about, but that's one of the main ways in which they're used nowadays. Not all institutions may have the ability to offer a muscle biopsy. The general surgery teams might not have the appropriate equipment, storage, processing, and pathology teams might not have the appropriate equipment, storage, and processing to handle the muscle biopsy. Muscle biopsies might not be indicated in certain instances. And again, just emphasizing that point where while this is generally considered a low-risk procedure, it still is a surgical procedure that requires general anesthesia, and all surgical procedures come with certain risks associated with them. And so, with that being said, that's my presentation today. Thank you guys so much for giving me a chance to speak with you all today, and I'd love to answer any questions you have.
Thank you so much, Jamie. We have a lot of questions in the chat, so I'm hoping you'll be able to stay on a little extra to try to get through some of these. And they're really, really great questions. So thank you everybody for submitting your questions. I wanted to start with that last slide that you just had up, where you said muscle biopsies can provide functional support for VUS. Can you dive into that a little deeper before we get started with the questions?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have, I'll start by saying we have over 400 genes that are related to mitochondrial function, both in the nuclear DNA and in the mitochondrial DNA. Let's say a person has two variants of uncertain significance in a complex one gene. Picking one complex one gene in the nuclear DNA, NDUFS8 is one complex one gene. You might look at a person and say, oh, this person looks like the other people who have NDUFS8 reported in the literature. But both of these are variants of uncertain significance, and the constellation of symptoms is not enough to say this is the answer. So what might you do? You might do a muscle biopsy or a skin biopsy, and then you can look at complex one's function. And if complex one's function is deficient or abnormal, then you now have created a lot stronger evidence for saying, okay, not only does my patient's symptoms look like other people with this specific gene, but they also have a complex one abnormality, which is very specific to this gene. So you've now just created a much stronger argument that those variants of uncertain significance that maybe haven't been reported before in the literature are probably causing your patient's symptoms.
Okay, I think that's super helpful because I think that yeah, sometimes it's confusing as to why when do you need to go take that next step for muscle biopsy and when it could be helpful. You mentioned the blood and the buccal versus saliva, and is would you consider, and then somebody put also as a question, they were asking about MitoSwab, which I think is a different category, but I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit to using the blood, buccal versus saliva, and if you like how those are used or how it's determined which one is used. And then also, if you can speak a little bit to MitoSwab and what your opinions are on that.
So for blood, buccal, and saliva samples for genetic testing, like exome sequencing, panel testing, genome sequencing, they are used interchangeably. And a lot of times it is a decision that's sort of made on a practical basis. How easy is it to give blood? How old is the patient? Can they do a cheek swab if they don't do, or sorry, can they do a saliva kit if they can't do blood? If they can't do a saliva kit, can they do a cheek swab? And so one of the reasons for this is when you look at cheek swab and you look at saliva samples, many of the cells that they're actually obtaining DNA from are actually the same cells from blood. They're leukocytes that come from microscopic cuts in our cheek that just happen as we eat food. And so there's been a lot of studies showing that the sample types, blood, buccal swab, saliva samples, are, roughly speaking, similar enough that they can be used interchangeably for sort of that first tier testing, exome with mtDNA, genome panels, et cetera. Now for the buccal swab, so the buccal swab is considered somewhat debated within the mitochondrial community. The buccal swab looks at the electron transport chain within individuals' cheek swabs. And at least at CHOP, our policy is that we do not interpret cheek swab ETCs, buccal swab electron transport chain results. And this is because there has only been one group that has been able to replicate consistent results within cheek swabs. And this is actually a stance that was taken by the expert panel in terms of reviewing cases in the literature for functional evidence, is that a cheek swab electron transport chain evidence was not considered appropriate to use for scoring likelihood of a mitochondrial disease. And I know that's debated in the community, but that's sort of our stance on the matter.
No, that's helpful to know. It's helpful to know that clinics might have different stances, but also that that's what y'all's stance is. What about the mito swab? What's y'all's opinion about that?
Oh, sorry, that's what I was referring to with the mito
With the
swab.
buccal swab?
Yep,
Oh, okay.
let me clarify that one point. So mito swab is a cheek swab that tests the electron transport chain.
Okay.
That is the test that, at CHOP and the Mayo Clinic, we don't interpret those results. Cheek swab genetic testing, like exome sequencing, genome sequencing, panel testing, that is routinely done, and we absolutely do interpret genetic testing done on cheek swabs. We don't interpret the electron transport chain on cheek swabs. Yeah, sorry
Okay.
for any confusion in my
No,
response.
that's super helpful. That's super helpful. I'm gonna give a specific patient example, and I'll let you kind of explore this a little bit. And then there's some really good general questions too that I'm gonna try to hit in the chat. This patient says, "How would you interpret an arm muscle biopsy showing ragged red and Cox negative fibers consistent with mitochondrial myopathy when genetic testing is negative? Other tests are largely unremarkable, but there are additional blood and urine markers, brain lesions, liver dysfunction, rapid onset of severe symptoms, and markedly reduced respiratory muscle strength. MIP 40%, MEP 16%. So how would you tackle
Yeah,
that question?
that's a really good question. And I'll admit, I'm not sure it's a question that I can answer in a complete form through this venue. I think what's probably best, because it's very hard to know without looking at medical records themselves, what sort of the timing of the biopsy was, what sort of the degree of abnormalities were. I think the best thing there would be to follow up with a genetics clinic that has mitochondrial expertise to synthesize all of those pieces together. And I know that that's probably not the most satisfying response, but I'm not sure I can do the response much more justice.
It sounds like what you're seeing is that there's a lot of variables, kind of like you talked in initially too, just in regards to when you get a muscle biopsy, there's lots of different variables, and if the test isn't done appropriately, then that can change one test versus the next test if you got multiple biopsies. And so, like, I guess and that a question that kind of relates to that is, and nobody would ever do this, but let's say a patient got two different muscle biopsies the same day, and it got sent to the lab. Theoretically, if it was mishandled, then they could show two very different things, which is why clinical symptoms are so important.
That's correct. And one thing that happens inevitably is I will say, this is my opinion. I do think mitochondrial myopathy probably gets overcalled on muscle biopsy histology, like ragged red fibers and Cox negative fibers, in people who are over the age of 50 or 60, because we know we acquire these findings around that time of our life. And some labs will interpret a single Cox negative fiber or a single ragged red fiber as consistent with a mitochondrial myopathy. But if that's in someone who's 60 years old, that could be within normal limits. And so there's lots of you summarize that well, Stephanie. There's lots of considerations that sort of go into that thought process there.
So, a more general question a patient asked, does anesthesia impact the results of a muscle biopsy?
It's a good question, not that I know of. But I will say that's not something that I have done deep research into, but I haven't heard anybody discuss that anesthesia would impact the results of muscle biopsy.
So you discussed discovering the amount of heteroplasmy via muscle biopsy. Are there other ways to discover heteroplasmy for certain conditions outside of muscle biopsy?
So you can look in probably the most commonly tested samples. I'll lump blood, cheek swab, and saliva into one. And then urine is a very common sample that is tested. And then muscle. Those are kind of the three most common groups of tissues that are tested. Many labs can do that offer mitochondrial DNA testing can do mitochondrial DNA analysis on any tissue that DNA can be extracted from. And so like fibroblasts, skin fibroblasts are often tested for mitochondrial DNA variants as well. But just in terms of ease of sample collection, the most commonly tested samples are, again, those three: blood, cheek swab, saliva. Urine is sort of an intermediate because urine's a little bit more reflective of muscle levels than it is of blood or cheek swab or saliva levels. And it's not invasive, which is one of the values of urine. And then muscle biopsy being sort of the rule out invasive option, but only a tissue that can be definitively used to exclude mtDNA variants.
So, do they at times use all three as a way to have a better understanding of what the actual heteroplasmy is so they're not having to do a muscle biopsy, or does
Yeah,
that not
so
work?
we have avoided needing to do muscle biopsy in people because we found now it needs to be a pathogenic variant or a likely pathogenic variant, and it needs to be present at a high enough level where it's considered diagnostic, but we have avoided muscle biopsies in some patients by doing urine heteroplasmy analysis or urine mitogenome sequencing.
Can you talk a little bit more about about the urine tests and what they can rule out with mitochondrial disease or in, for that matter?
Yeah, so largely there are two versions of the urine test. So urine looks at just mitochondrial DNA. And so at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, we do offer a comprehensive urine mitogenome. So it is the same test that gets done often in blood, cheek swab, or saliva. But to my knowledge, there are no other labs in the United States that do the full mitochondrial DNA sequencing in urine. And you know, the analogy I gave of the 35-year-old man, and I mentioned he had a muscle biopsy, and the mitochondrial DNA deletion was detected at 40% in his muscle. I could have equally had written that story out that urine mitogenome sequencing and deletion analysis was done, and the deletion was present at 30% in his urine, which would be considered diagnostic. And so urine testing can identify mitochondrial DNA disorders that might not be present in blood or cheek swab. But in order for it to be confirmatory, that percentage, that heteroplasmy level, does need to be high enough to be considered diagnostic. Which, generally speaking, and I didn't say this in the talk, but heteroplasmy levels less than 25% are not considered diagnostic. And the reason for this is we actually know that many people in the general population can carry pathogenic mitochondrial DNA variants, but they're at low levels, 5%, 10%. And if you think about that, that means 90% of the mitochondrial DNA in that tissue are functioning normally. And so the general rule of thumb is if variants across multiple tissues are all under 25%, that's an insufficient level to be causing someone's symptoms.
So, I mean, I know there's always exceptions to rules. I'm just curious, like in regards to like if you have a super rare variant, maybe there's only three or four people in the world and you end up with a threshold that's like 24%, you know? Like, will some geneticists consider it, or how do you approach that?
25% is a pretty hard cutoff for most geneticists, I would say. There's always case-by-case exceptions. But I think most geneticists would have to have a very compelling explanation as to why a variant would be causing symptoms at less than 25%. And I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I do think there would have to be a lot of pieces of strong evidence that would go into convincing a geneticist of that, though.
Okay. So I'm going to combine two questions together. A patient just asked, how often do you see changes in muscle biopsies over the course of a decade that isn't necessarily related to aging? And then there was another patient then that kind of asked along the same line. They got a muscle biopsy, but the skeletal muscle, the surgeon didn't capture the skeletal tissue. And so they're trying to debate, do they have the procedure again? You know, what should they factor into that decision?
Yeah, really good questions. And starting with the first one, so it's hard to know because serial bi well, there are certainly people who have had serial biopsies. There isn't a lot of clear literature on the changes that happen over time with serial biopsies to know for sure what happens. And so I think one of the things that we have learned from a mitochondrial perspective is that we recently put out a paper and we saw with multiple mitochondrial DNA deletions, while they have been associated with mitochondrial diseases, all of our patients over the age of 50 had multiple mitochondrial DNA deletions in their muscle tissue at low levels of heteroplasmy, under 10%. And we noticed that people in their 40s, about 75% of them had it. And people in their 30s, only about 50% or 40% had it. And very few people under the age of 20 had these changes. And so I think that there is something that happens around age 40 or 50 where we start to acquire mitochondrial changes like Cox negative fibers, ragged red fibers, multiple mitochondrial DNA deletions. And so thinking about a biopsy that's a decade apart, I think one thing that would factor into that, of course, would be sort of the age of the person that's getting the biopsy. It was the first biopsy at 20 and then at 30, 30, then 40, 40, then 50. And in terms of other muscle disorders, I'll say that's where I am a bit limited. My training, my expertise is in mitochondrial diseases, and I have a passing familiarity with the differential diagnoses for mitochondrial diseases, but I don't have the specific knowledge to know how, for example, things like muscular dystrophy, muscle biopsies change over time. So that's where I'm a bit limited in terms of my ability to answer that part of the question. And I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the second
Yeah, I
question.
know because I realized as you were talking that actually was a lot bigger of a question than I realized. And I guess I also was thinking like as you age and you're producing less mitochondria, from that standpoint, does that affect your muscle biopsies as well? Is kind of I think maybe something you've alluded to or
I'm so sorry. I missed the first part of that. Could you repeat that, Stephanie?
No, I was curious as you're aging and you're producing less mitochondria, does that affect your muscle biopsies as well? Yeah. There's more to that question, but I want to make sure I get this one in too. This person said that they had a muscle biopsy, but unfortunately the surgeon didn't capture the skeletal muscle. And so they're trying to decide the pros and cons of getting the procedure again, what would you fact just generally like what would you factor into a decision like that as you were talking with a patient?
Yeah, I think things that I would factor in, even putting myself in a patient role, what would I think about? I would think about what does having a diagnosis mean to me and the importance of a diagnosis mean to me? Even if there's no specific treatment changes from having the diagnosis, what does that mean to me? And then on the flip side of that, I would think about what does doing an invasive test and not having explanation for my symptoms mean to me? I would balance those two. And then I would think about what was this process like last time? Was it easy? Was it hard? Was it painful? Was it not super painful? I would balance those together and raise those to my doctor and then see what my doctor said in response to my thoughts on those matter. But that would be, you know, if I were to put myself in a patient's shoes, that would be how I would think about that situation.
So you mentioned deletions, and okay, so I'm going to try to see if I can formulate this question. You mentioned deletions, and you're reviewing muscle biopsies. That this can be difficult to determine because if you're not exercising, that can change the number of mitochondria that you have. But I'm curious, like, if you have like a patient, and it looks like there's like some deletion situations going on. How do you evaluate how much they're exercising? Is there a systematic way that you're able to comparatively look at, okay, we have these deletions going on, this is the amount a patient is exercising and comparing, or does that not really exist?
It's a great question. It doesn't really exist. And so, you know, currently it's very much just like a gestalt that we take when we look back through our histories. You know, was this person able to walk? Was this person admitted to the hospital and in a bed for 3 months when they got their muscle biopsy? There's sort of no formal measurement of exercise capacity. And there is one point that I think I've glossed over that I do want to delineate. When we think about mitochondrial DNA deletions, there's sort of two different categories that we think about. People who have a single deletion in their mitochondrial DNA, meaning there is one piece of DNA that is missing, that is a definitive diagnosis called a single large-scale mitochondrial DNA deletion disorder. And this is in contrast to people who have multiple deletions in their mitochondrial DNA. And while that might be a little bit counterintuitive, what multiple deletions refer to is, remember, we have multiple copies of mitochondrial DNA. One copy might have a deletion from this point to this point. Another copy might have a deletion from that point to that point. But usually what we find with people who have multiple deletions is that the combination of all their deletions together is still present at a relatively low level, less than 10%, as opposed to people who have the single deletion who usually have that at higher levels, you know, 30%, 40%, maybe even higher. And the multiple deletions, while they can suggest a mitochondrial disorder, they're not exclusive to mitochondrial disorders. And this is contrasted with single deletions, which are definitive mitochondrial disorders. And that's a very high-level technical distinction that we make in clinic, that I did just want to make sure that I clearly delineated.
No, that's super helpful. That's super helpful because there's all these tiny details that sometimes it's really hard to understand. And when we talk about deletions, it can mean a variety of different things. So I'm really glad that you shed some light on that. We have so many more questions, and I'm curious if you have at least 5 extra minutes, or do you have planning?
I have about maybe 15 extra minutes at most. I do
Okay,
have to
okay.
talk at 1:30, but yes, I do have some.
I mean, this is good. This shows how much the community is, curious and really wants to better understand.
Yeah, absolutely.
One patient asks, is a skin biopsy used to look at the electron transport chain? Can mitomyopathy be diagnosed from that biopsy?
Good question. So there's two questions there. The first is yes, skin biopsy can be used to look at the electron transport chain. The second question is a bit tricky to answer. So I wouldn't say direct. Mitomyopathy describes someone who has a mitochondrial disease and has muscle symptoms. And classically, it's been described when people get the biopsy and they look at the muscle fibers and there's Rankin fibers and Cox negative fibers. So by doing a skin biopsy alone, you wouldn't get that information. But if a skin biopsy showed strong evidence of mitochondrial disease and a person has muscle symptoms, most people would then end up saying mitochondrial myopathy. And I realize that seems like it's splitting hairs. But the short answer is no, not technically. But if someone has muscle symptoms and the skin biopsy is really abnormal and really looks like a mitochondrial disease, people then might use the term mitochondrial myopathy just to simplify things. What probably would be used instead would be if the skin biopsy is abnormal, they would say this person has this deficiency, complex 1 deficiency, complex 4 deficiency, combined oxidative phosphorylation deficiency, if it's 1 and 4. That would probably be used instead of a mitochondrial myopathy diagnosis. But that's something that also, that's just my opinion that would vary from provider to provider.
As we're talking a little bit about the electron transport chain, another patient asked if they're taking riboflavin, should that be stopped before any electron transport chain testing? And if so, how long should it be stopped beforehand?
Yeah. So that unfortunately, that's a bit of a medical advice question that I'm not sure that I can directly answer, but riboflavin is thought to feed into the TCA cycle, which then in turn feeds into the electron transport chain. And the general thought is that riboflavin supports activity of the electron transport chain. It is possible that it could impact results, but I don't think we have data that say for this number of weeks, stop it to show the natural electron transport chain. We don't have any clear data to show that. And there's also a risk benefit. Riboflavin can help with migraines. And if your migraines get worse in that period, that's obviously detrimental as well. And so that's definitely a conversation that's best had with your provider, because there's a risk benefit of what does stopping the riboflavin do versus trying to get the electron transport chain results as close to their natural state as possible, and keeping in mind that that's a very theoretical discussion. Nobody's really done studies to show how it directly affects it.
Do muscle biopsies have to be done on live tissue, since they measure energy? Are they ever done, after someone passes away for gene research purposes?
That's a really good question. They can be in terms of processing post-mortem tissues, it does need to be handled correctly. And the big thing is freezing tissue at a very certain window after someone has passed. But if it was collected and frozen within that window, yes, it can be done.
And you mentioned that there's not many hospitals doing the muscle biopsies these days. What are the hospitals in the US that are most, well, they asked what hospitals in the US are best at performing accurate muscle biopsies, but maybe even the question is which ones are still doing them, or which I think there's maybe two, are there only two labs that are
Yeah,
evaluating them?
it's a good question. So I think many of the mitochondrial care network centers of excellence, I think many of those places will at least know how to get a muscle biopsy. I don't know, they might not do it at their specific institution, but they likely partner with another institution that does muscle biopsies. And so that would be maybe the place that I would check first. And then in terms of the labs that offer, many labs offer mitochondrial DNA sequencing. It's really the electron transport chain analysis. And that is only offered by Baylor Genetics and Colorado Children's Hospital. Those are the only two labs that offer electron transport chain. And Colorado Children's Hospital is the only lab in the country that offers blue native gel electrophoresis of the electron transport chain. And we do like to pair the two together. Electron transport chain is the more classic and more canonically known test, but the blue native gel electrophoresis can be helpful in certain instances.
What is that? The blue native? Yeah, I mean, you mentioned it, so now I gotta
Yeah.
ask.
So, it's basically a different way of looking at the electron transport chain. And the way I describe it is that the respiratory chain analysis, the electron transport chain analysis is basically like treating each complex like it's a battery and checking the voltage coming from that battery. And the blue native gel electrophoresis takes a little bit of a different approach. And it's not quite as quantitative, it doesn't give us a specific percentage or number, but it looks to see is the right amount of this complex present, or is there not as much complex that should be present, which is sort of looking at it in a different way. If we think about these batteries as having multiple pieces to come together, are all the pieces of the battery coming together or not?
That's interesting. And Colorado is the only place that does that. Children's
Clinically,
Hospital.
in the
Interesting.
clinically in the United States, that's the only place that offers. I imagine there are researchers who will do it, but to my knowledge, it's the only place that you will get a test report back from.
This patient asked, how does one distinguish muscle biopsy findings consistent with mitochondrial disease versus changes in mitochondrial function related to heart failure?
Oh, that is really hard. I don't know that I have a good answer for that because that certainly can happen. When you think about heart function, our heart is so essential for pumping our blood, which by extension is essential for pumping our oxygen, and changing oxygen levels can really do abnormal things to the mitochondria. And so unfortunately, I don't know that there is a good way to distinguish that.
So, I know that we are limited on time and there are more questions. So, what I'm going to tell people, I'm going to put my, when I stop recording, I will put my email in the chat. If I did not get to your question and still really burning, email me, let me know. I'll reach out to Jamie and see if I can get you an answer. You guys asked amazing questions today. We might have to bring them back. There's still lots of unanswered questions in this world of genetics that we would love to have answers to. And we'd love to be able to get to them. So I just want to thank you for coming, Jamie, for answering these questions and for being with us in this space today. And really appreciate your hard work and everything that you do. And I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you all so much for inviting me to speak today. I really appreciate the opportunity, and I hope everybody has a good weekend.
Take care.
Take care.